Okay. Hello. Good morning. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there, including my dad who showed up today. It's good to see everybody. We're going to be continuing our series in Mark. So we'll be in chapter 10 today. You may want to turn there. It's the second gospel in the New Testament. So you've got Matthew, then Mark. I'm going to go ahead and pray while you turn there. Well, Father, on Father's Day, I want to thank you for you. I thank you, God, that you do provide the right example for us, that you do care for us, that your love doesn't let us down. I thank you so much, God, that you have given us passages like this one that help us to learn about marriage and what your thoughts on marriage are, God. And I pray today that we can learn something together about what you have to say about that. Amen. Okay, so we are in Mark chapter 10, and this is a part in Mark that's interesting because the Pharisees asked Jesus about divorce, not specifically marriage, but divorce. And that is something that, you know, we should think about. You know, our culture, the divorce rate among non-Christians is right around 50% or so, and the divorce rate around Christians is pretty much the same. You know, we should know better. So it tells us that there's something fundamentally broken, not with marriage itself, but with us. You know, there are people that would tell you, well, there's something wrong with marriage. Maybe we weren't designed for it. The Bible has something else to say, that we are designed for it. Marriage is God's design for us. However, we are broken. So, you know, you got two broken people together. It's difficult. It's difficult not to have problems. So we're going to look at what Jesus had to say about marriage and divorce today. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, "Getting up, he went from there to the region of Judea." So he was in Galilee, and Jesus gets up with his disciples and his followers, and he heads out to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered around him again, and according to his custom, he once more began to teach them. And some Pharisees came up to Jesus. And remember, the Pharisees are the religious elite of the time. They were real strict, legalistic people who you thought you reached God through law, through obedience through the law. And they didn't like Jesus. So they came up to him, and they were testing him, and they began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife. And he answered and said to them, "Well, what did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." So here we go. Here we are. We got Jesus, and he's got the crowds, and he's teaching them. And then we got these Pharisees coming up to him, and they want to test him. So we need to keep that firmly in our mind. These Pharisees are not coming up to Jesus asking for marital counseling. They're not coming to tap into his great wisdom. They're coming in here to test him and to trap him. They're trying to get it to trip him up to say something that will turn the crowds against him and get him in trouble. That's what they're doing. You remember early on in Mark 3, we read that the Pharisees were getting together with these Herodian Jews who were following Herod, and they normally hated each other, but they decided to get together and go against Jesus because they hated him even more. So they're plotting against him. They're trying to get him in trouble. And the trap that they're laying for him is about divorce. They're asking him about whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife. And the reason they're doing that, there's a few reasons that they picked this one. They tried to hit him with taxes. You know, they tried to hit him with several different things. Divorce is another. It was a divisive topic at the time. And, you know, there were really two schools of thought about divorce. Moses laid down the law about divorce in, which Jesus quotes here at the end of this passage in verse 4. It's in Deuteronomy 24, I believe, and he talks about, you know, you're allowed to divorce your wife. But he's not real specific on the details. Moses was a little vague on the details. So there were two schools of thought here. It was, what it says in there is if a husband finds any uncleanliness or anything he doesn't like about his wife, he's not specific, but he's allowed to divorce her. And so the one school of thought said, well, that means that divorce is really strict. He doesn't lay out strict rules for divorce because we really shouldn't be getting divorced at all. And so it should be really difficult to get divorced. The other view, which was much more popular, was that you should be able to divorce for any reason. You know, she slept in and forgot to make your breakfast. That's it. She's out. You know, she forgot your birthday. She's gone. And so there were these two schools of thoughts were very prominent. In fact, it was so easy to get a divorce. All the Jews had to do, a Jewish man had to do was to divorce his wife, was to say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. Say it three times, and she's out. Which I imagine if you're having an argument, you say it twice, you know, that ends the argument pretty quick, right? You'll make me say it again. So there was an issue there. Because what would happen was, women didn't have a means to take care of themselves. And so the husband, the word divorce literally means to send away. So the husband would just send her away. And she would have no means to take care of herself. Often they fell into prostitution or they would fall into begging. It was a mess. And, you know, it wasn't really good for the woman in a divorce in those days. So they're trying to trap him because they want him to take a side. In either side that he takes, he's bound to alienate the other side of the argument. But I think it goes deeper than that, too. If you remember, John the Baptist, he was beheaded by King Herod. And one of the things that he was beheaded for was because he was very critical of King Herod. Herod had a brother who was married, and Herod fell in love with his brother's wife. So he left his wife and married his brother's wife. And John the Baptist was very critical, publicly critical of Herod for that, telling him it was sin, telling him it was adultery. You can't just set aside a wife like that and pick up a new one. You can't do that. You can't marry your brother's wife. It's wrong. And so they had him arrested, and Herod's new wife asked for him to be beheaded, so he was. So maybe they're also, I think, they're trying to hope that Jesus will maybe pick up on that and say, well, yeah, Herod was wrong for what he did, and maybe get him in trouble with Herod, and that'll take care of the problem. So this was a hot topic. And instead of just speaking from his own authority, which he had the right to do, he decided to go back to the law itself. He said, what did Moses command? What's the law? What did Moses say about divorce? And so they said, and they're quoting from Deuteronomy 24, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. So what that means is, you know, instead of just sending them away with nothing, the certificate of divorce would allow them to reclaim their dowry, so they would have something to live on, and so they were taken care of a little bit. At least they had something to live on, and they didn't go away empty-handed and homeless. So he says that's the law, but he goes on and says something pretty interesting. He goes, the law is not the end of it. He says, Jesus said to them, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote through this commandment. It wasn't, say, because God likes divorce. It was because of your hardness of heart that he wrote this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female, and for this reason, man shall leave his father and his mother, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So Jesus gives us a little insight into the law that that Moses wrote down. He says it was because of their hardness of heart that he wrote that commandment. You know, they were sending their women away with nothing. And they had no means to take care of themselves. And it wasn't just that. They had their hearts hardened towards each other. It was because he knew that we're broken. He knew that we can sometimes not get along. He knows this, and so he allows for divorce. Now remember, what was the purpose of the law? Are you familiar with the New Testament? Jesus, a couple of times, and Paul said the purpose of the law was to reveal sin. And Paul talks a lot about that in Romans, how the purpose, he didn't even know about coveting. He didn't covet about anything until he read the law that said, thou shalt not covet. And what did he do? He started coveting even more. It brought his attention to the sin in his heart. And this law is no different. It was because of their hardness of heart that he had to allow for divorce, because it brings out the sin that's involved in that marriage. You know, we can have hardened hearts towards each other and become embittered towards one another, and we have to allow for divorce because of our hardness of heart, and it allows us to learn from that. And you know, I know that a lot of people who end up with divorced end up chronically divorcing. You know, they get married again and they divorce again. But I also know tons of people, especially right here in this room, that are not on their first marriage. They're on their second marriage at least, and yet they learn something from that divorce. They learn something from the previous divorce about who they are. It comes from when we stop blaming, putting 100% of the blame on the other person and understand our role in the divorce, then we can learn from that. And God can soften our hearts. And then we can end up with a better marriage the second time around because we understand better who we are, we understand better who God is and what he wants from us. So it was because of their hardness of heart that he wrote that commandment. He said, but then he goes on to the beginning, to the origin of marriage. And this is right out of Genesis. He says, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. And for this reason, man shall leave his father and his mother. The two shall become one flesh. They are no longer two, but one flesh. That he's saying, all right, because of our brokenness, or your brokenness, I should say, because Jesus is saying, because of your brokenness, God allowed for divorce. But it was never his design. He never wanted us to be divorced. When he created marriage, he created it for a man and a woman to be together and to become so intimate together and in a relationship that's so loving that they become one flesh. And so a divorce then would be like tearing off your arm because you're so connected that you're one. That's what a marriage is supposed to be like. And so to allow for divorce, to have a divorce, it should be not taken lightly. You don't tear off your leg when you stub your toe. It doesn't make sense. You know, there has to be a serious problem with a body part for you to remove it. Even the appendix, which isn't even that important. They don't just take it out preemptively. They wait for something to happen. Because you don't do anything like that lightly. So that's God's design for marriage, and it's because this is the most intimate relationship two human beings can have with one another. You know, it is a mirror of God's relationship within the Trinity. And we're designed to have deep, meaningful relationships, and he's designed this specific relationship, that of marriage, to be something so intimate that we become one and we start to realize our relationship with God is supposed to be like this. It's supposed to mirror that. So that's the purpose of it. So that's why he says then, what God has joined together, let no man separate. It's not God's design for us to get married, or for us to get divorced. It's not his will for us to be divorced. It happens, but it should never be taken lightly, and it's never something that we should just plan on. I splashed myself with my tea. I divorce you. All right, so that's what we're talking about with marriage. So there's the key to this passage, I think, is where he says it was because of your hardness of heart. There is something about having a hardened heart that can lead to divorce and it can lead to unhappy marriages. And we need to address that, I think, because that is really the point of this passage where he's saying, they're talking about divorce and they're trying to capture him. And he's turning it right around on him and saying, look, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. In fact, it's against God's will that you get divorced. And it's only because you're broken. It's only because you have these hard hearts that he allows it. So let's take a look at that. What does it mean? Oh, I wanted to go into Timothy Keller before I get into the hard hearts. Tim Keller wrote this book called Meaning of Marriage, which is a great book. It describes what marriage is for, why God has it, you know, why he, the purpose of it is. It's a very neat book. He says, in Western culture today, you decide to get married because you feel an attraction to the other person. You think he or she is wonderful, but a year or two later, or just as often, a month or two, three things usually happen. First, you begin to find out how selfish this wonderful person is. Second, you discover that the wonderful person has been going through a similar experience, and he or she begins to tell you how selfish you are. And third, though you acknowledge it in part, you conclude that your spouse's selfishness is much more problematic than your own. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Yeah. This resonated with me. When I first read this book, I'm like getting the highlighter out. I highlighted this because it's exactly what happened. My wife and I, it took us about 2 or 3 years. And then we just started, you know, we started to discover some things about each other that we didn't like. You know, we are good at hiding our craziness for a time, especially when you are infatuated with another person. I said infatuated, not in love. When we are trying to woo someone, right, when we're trying to date someone, we are really good at putting our best face forward. You know, we hide how crazy we are. And so then when we get married and we're like cooped up together, then all of a sudden the crazy starts slipping out. And we start making mistakes, and we start realizing just how awful that other person is, right? And we would say, well, they changed, right? And that's not the truth at all. The funny thing is, Keller in this book, he says, when you get married with someone, it doesn't bring you into conflict with them. It brings you into conflict with yourself. That's the truth. How selfish am I going to be? So when we were married for 2 or 3 years, in our third year, we were divvying up our stuff. I mean, we were like, all right, well, I will get the TV, and you get the computer, and that couch goes with you. I mean, that's how far it was with us. And it was, and if you'd asked us what had happened, we'd have said we grew apart. You know, we got married within that 3 years. Dawn had graduated. I was still in school. She got a job in her field, which means she had to start at the bottom and start working second shift. We never saw each other. We grew apart. And the truth of the matter is, that's not what happened. We didn't grow apart. We were the same people. We didn't change. We just, that infatuation faded, and we started to really see the rough edges. And we concluded that our spouse's selfishness was more problematic than our own. Each of us made that decision about the other. You know, this is not 50-50. The problem here is really 10-90. You know, you're 90% of the problem, I'm only 10%. And my 10% is really only incidental. You know, that's how we feel. I wouldn't be this way if you didn't act that way, which is a lie. So that happens in every marriage. And what ends up occurring then is that our hearts become hardened. And so that's what I wanted to talk about. What does it mean to have a hard heart? And usually when we're trying to describe something like this, it's metaphorical, it's good to describe the opposite too. That way we can contrast the two. Someone with a hard heart may demand your own way. We demand our own way. Remember the Pharaoh. That's one of the most popular passages in the Old Testament that talks about a hardened heart. This Pharaoh, and Moses is dealing with Pharaoh, and he's trying to get him to let his people go, right? The Jews are enslaved in Egypt, and he goes to Pharaoh on multiple occasions and said, let my people go. And Pharaoh, it says two things. Sometimes it says his heart was hardened, or he hardened his heart. And sometimes it even says God hardened his heart. And what that means is it solidified his determination on the decision that he'd already made. He'd made a decision not to let them go, and so he solidified that decision. It bolstered that decision, and he became harder, and he said no. No matter what plagues hit him, no matter what happened, no matter what bad circumstances occurred, his heart was fixed on not letting them go. And that happens in our hearts. Have you ever been that way? You know, you're kind of, this is my opinion, and all of a sudden your spouse does something you don't like, and all of a sudden your opinion becomes a hard and fast rule. You know, I am not backing down on this. Does that happen to anybody? Whereas a soft heart will concede to the spouse. Soft heart realizes it's more important to be happy than to be right all the time. You know, unless we're talking about moral issues, it's okay to let your spouse have the right, have the last word, win the argument. It's okay. A softened heart knows there's more important things than being right all the time and being in charge. Sometimes we look at it like it's some kind of a respect thing. If I'm not right and if she doesn't concede, then she doesn't respect me. And that's a lie. That's an absolute lie. So a softened heart will back off on that stance and be comfortable enough to say, all right, you know, we'll go your way. Viewing a spouse in a negative light, the hardened heart will see everything your spouse does as a personal affront to you, right? You know, the spouse can do this or they can do that, and it can be taken either way, but we choose the negative way to view the spouse. You know, I used to complain about this early in our marriage. I would say something, You know, oftentimes Dawn and I, when I think things are funny, she finds them offensive. And, you know, so I would say something that's witty and she would find it repulsive or insulting, right? And so I'm like, you always take the negative approach. You know, you assume the worst out of me. And that's what we do, right? We assume the worst out of our spouses. Even when they're doing something nice. Well, he's only doing that because he wants me to feel guilty. He's only doing that because he wants something. She's only doing that because she ran up the credit card, right? We have these thoughts in our heads that we just assume the worst out of our spouses. Whereas a soft heart, though, will give the benefit of the doubt. This is someone I love. This is someone that I married. This is someone I stood up in front of my friends and my family and before God and declared, I will love you forever. I need to assume the best out of this person. I mean, we all make mistakes, and sometimes we all do mean things. But that doesn't mean we're awful people, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't love one another. A softened heart will give the benefit of the doubt to the spouse. Now, a hard heart will judge motives. You know, this kind of same along the same lines, will judge the motives. I know you're doing that because you want me to feel guilty, or you're doing that because you want to hurt me or disrespect me in some way. You know, guys, especially, we complain that our wives want us to be mind readers, don't we? She expects me to know this. How was I supposed to know that she was mad about that? You know, right? We complain about being, they want us to be mind readers. And then what do? We pretend we're mind readers. She's only doing that because of this. Right? We pretend that we're mind readers at the same time complaining that they want us to be mind readers. You know, this is awful. We can't judge another person's motives. We can't. We can only see their actions. In Proverbs 16:2, he says, the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. You know, all of us think that what we're doing is the right thing to do at the time. That's why when we're sinning, we try to justify it, right? Well, I'm justified in doing this. We always think we're on the right path at the time, but God knows our motives. Who judges motives? God. He's the only one that can see in our hearts. He knows us better than we know ourselves. We can't judge our spouse's motives. Instead, all we can do is look at their actions. And in looking at their actions, we can decide to view them in as positive a light as possible, giving the benefit of the doubt. Now, that again, I'm not talking about abuse situations here. He's only hitting me because he loves me is not something you should be saying. Okay? But we're talking about the small things that occur over years that harden our hearts towards each other. Focusing on our own feelings, we get so turn our eyes inward and we focus on how we've been hurt and how our feelings have been slighted that we ignore the ones of our spouses, whereas a soft heart will focus on our spouse's feelings. A soft heart will look at our spouse and say, all right, she's hurt, obviously, because she's acting this way. I should focus on why is she hurt. In Philippians 2:3-4, Paul says this to Christians in general, and it should really apply even more to married couples, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interest of others. How much more so does that apply to marriage? You know, we focus on our own hurts and our own wounds, and we ignore those of our spouse. That is a hardened heart. A soft heart is able to overlook our own wounds and look into the heart of someone else. You know, a hard heart will harbor bitterness. It's been said that bitterness is anger without the energy, right? It's just we've got these things that we hate and we stew on them and we think about them and we play these records over and over again, or we've got this list of offenses that we read in our minds over and over again. And we get angry and we get bitter. And we treat our spouses poorly because of that. But a soft heart captures those thoughts. There's a passage in 2 Corinthians that's really talking about spiritual warfare because it takes place in our minds. And one of the things it says here is we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. You can't just let thoughts drift through your head. You've got to fight back. That's not true. You've got to run these bitter thoughts through God's framework and say, nope, that's a lie. I can't believe that. I'm not going to dwell on that thought because it's inaccurate. It's wrong. It's flat out a lie. I can't believe it. I'm not going to allow myself to think of my wife that way. You know, I'd be angry at anybody else who said something like that about my wife, but I'll run it through my head and it's okay. You know, we've got to take our thoughts captive. We've got to discipline our thinking. We can't just let our thoughts go wherever they will, because they can go negative pretty quick. And so this is the hard heart versus the soft heart. And in God's mercy and wisdom, he allowed Don and I to have an argument recently. And it serves as a case study for this. I asked Don first. I said, do you mind if I talk about that argument we had on Memorial Day weekend? And she's like, no, that's fine. So this is with her blessing. And she's going to listen to this on CD. She's out teaching one of the kids. They're teaching the kids in one of the rooms. So I have to be good here. But, you know, we had this argument. I'm not going to get into the details, but I did something that made her angry. And I didn't think it was any big deal. And she got really angry with me. And I thought, wow, she's really overreacting. Now, I had the option to think, well, she's got feelings here about this. Obviously, this made her angry. She's a rational human being. She's not going to get angry for no reason. So I should find out what's going on. What I said was, you're pretty cranky. You should probably get back to bed. So there was mistake number one. I disregarded her feelings altogether, right? I did not assume that she was being rational. I assumed that she was being irrational. And not only did I assume that, I told her so, right? You're just being cranky. And so I woke up in a really good mood that day, and it was early in the morning when that happened. So I was like, you know what? I'm not going to allow her anger to destroy my mood. I'm just going to let that go, and she'll eventually cool down and see what happened and come back and apologize, right? That's not what happened. I'm spoiling the story, but that's not what happened. So, you know, we go through that day. It was on a Saturday. This was Memorial Day weekend. So we go through Saturday, and we didn't talk much to each other. I mean, we were civil. We weren't, like, throwing things at each other, but we weren't talking much. And we certainly didn't bring up the elephant in the room. And we went through the day, and then we went to bed, and nothing was said. Nothing was said at all. And so the next day comes, and, you know, we had CT here, and we were also having a Memorial Day cookout for our home church and bringing some guests out, and so some of you were there probably at that. And we had this party, and we were fine. We didn't talk about it, and, you know, the longer it drew out, the more it wore on my good mood, and I was determined to stay in a good mood, and I failed in that determination because I was like, dang God, she's really dragging this out. And so Sunday comes and goes. And by Monday morning, I'm kind of angry, you know. And I'm not usually an angry person, and you know, when we argue, it's usually, you know, she gets angry and yells, and I get angry and I don't. And that's what had happened then. And you know, so the next morning, Monday morning, I meet with a friend of mine, and I'm telling him what's going on. And you know, I wasn't really looking for affirmation or advice. He listened and said, "Yeah, man, that stinks." But the more I'm talking about it out loud with a friend of mine, I was able to say, all right, you know, I probably should apologize here. You know, it's not like I was without fault altogether. So that's silly for me to drag this out. So in the afternoon, I said to her, you know, I apologize. You know, just because I didn't understand why you were angry doesn't mean you shouldn't have been. You know, so I apologized, and she had felt like I had disregarded her feelings, which I had. You know, I said, well, you need to talk about this. And she's like, why? you're not going to take me seriously. So I apologize. And then something funny happened. She didn't apologize back. And I'm like, all right, yeah, that's cool. And then the next day I started stewing on that, thinking, you know, I took all the responsibility for that fight. And she didn't say she was sorry. And the good news was I was able to recognize what was going on. I'm like, well, you know, that part of forgiveness, what forgiveness means is to give away your right to punish someone, right? That's what that means. So, you know, I'm like, I need to let that go. But it kept sitting with me, and it was hardening my heart. And I could tell. I recognized what was going on, which was what God was cool. God was telling me, you know, you can't let this go on. You got to fight this. And I didn't want to bring it up with her because I didn't want to think I was accusing her or fishing for an apology, you know, that kind of thing. So, You know, at least I did that. But my heart was hardened, you know. I demanded my own way at first. I was viewing her in a negative light. I was judging her motives. You know, I was doing all these things. I was focusing on my feelings. And what ended up happening is when on Thursday that week, we had a men's group, and I talked about what was going on. And as I was sharing and talking it out, it occurred to me that I should just write this letter. I wrote her a letter of apology. Sometimes, you know, when you're trying to apologize and then your spouse says something else and it can heat up into an argument again. And I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to write out again where I was wrong and not try to justify it at all. You know, I said, you know, this was my fault. I should never have done that. I should never have disregarded. Just because I was did not understand your feelings does not mean that they're not valid, is what I said. You know, and after 19 years of marriage, I still don't understand you well enough. That's my failing. And so that helped. You know, I was able to think that through and write it out, and I gave that to Dawn, and she said thank you and didn't apologize, and that's cool. Because I didn't, you know, it wasn't her fault. She shouldn't have to apologize. So there's the case study. That's what happens. You know, this is a small, isolated incident, but these things string together. What happens if I decided, you know what, it's her fault, and I decided not to talk about it, and it just fades away? We just let that, we'll forget that argument, and we go on to the next one. You know, and then a few months later, we have another one. Now I'm already predisposed to think she's overreacting again. I'm already predisposed to have my heart hardened. And after years of this pattern, we become alienated to one another. We don't like each other anymore. Not only do we not love each other, we don't even like each other anymore. And that's when the hardened hearts destroy families. So we have to be able to overcome these hardened hearts that we have. You have to be able to recognize these symptoms. Is anybody looking at this list of hardened hearts and thinking, boy, I really should apologize to my wife, or I should really tell my husband I'm sorry? Because all of this is a list of sins that we commit against our spouses. And this heart attitude can destroy marriages. And destroyed marriages can destroy families. And destroyed families can destroy home churches. And they have an effect. It's not just localized. When you're in a body of Christ, when you're in a church where people are sharing their lives with one another like they should, it affects more than just one person here. So we need to think about that. How can we overcome ourselves and be better at catching our hearts as they begin to harden and softening them up? I think the first thing we can do is begin a relationship with God. You know, that's where this starts. You know, I think it's almost impossible to have a successful marriage without a successful relationship with God. A marriage is supposed to be a reflection of God's relationship. If we don't know Him, how are we supposed to do that? How can we honor Him in our marriage that He designed if we don't know who He is? We don't have a relationship with Him. We need to be able to go to God and say, God, I am unable to have a marriage. I'm unable to be good enough for You. I'm certainly not good enough for my spouse. God, I want Christ's death to pay for my sins so I can have a relationship with You, and I want You to guide me here. You know, it's having this relationship with God that you cannot lose. You can't sin your way out of it. It's not performance-based. It's unconditional love that He gives us. That is significant in a marriage, because when we don't feel like we're being loved from our spouse the way we should, it's not the end of the world, because we are receiving the love from God. Your spouse is His primary way to show love to you in your life, but it's not His only way. And God will meet your love needs. And it takes the pressure off our spouse, because when you are 100% needy of your spouse to meet all of your love needs, you're putting pressure on this human being that cannot be met. It's impossible for a person to meet all those needs for somebody. Only God can meet our needs. So we have to begin our relationship with God and trust that He will meet our needs. And that frees us up then to love our spouses. We need to learn about our spouse. Remember I said that after 19 years, I still don't know her well enough. That's my sin. That's a sin in me. you know, it says in 1 Peter 3:7, he says, husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. That word understanding means knowledgeable. It means we need to be scholars of our spouses. We need to understand our spouses. We need to take the time to learn about them, how they think, how they feel. And if we can't predict everything that they're going to do in a given situation, we should at least try to understand why they react that way in a given situation. We need to be scholars. We need to have PhDs in our spouses. That's what we're called to do. That takes time and it takes effort. It takes conversations and observation. It also takes the willingness to give up that information. Sometimes we don't like to talk about ourselves. Sometimes we don't like to talk about things that happen in our past or whatever. But we have to be able to, if we can't talk to our spouse about these things, who can we talk to? If we can't talk to our spouse about our feelings, who can we talk to? This is supposed to be the most intimate relationship you can ever have with another human being. If you can't speak to this person, your marriage is broken. I've felt that way. Like, I can't talk to Don about this. That means there's something broken in my marriage. And if it's because I'm afraid of the reaction I'm going to get, then we need to work on that. We have to be scholars of one another in our marriages. But to speak love languages, I get this from a guy named Gary Chapman. He's a great marriage counselor. He writes several books. He has a book called Toward a Growing Marriage, which is a great book. Really, I think, turned my marriage around. And in that book, he has a chapter about these five love languages. And it's so important that he did a follow-up book called The Five Love Languages, which is another great book for marriages. And the idea here is that we, according to Chapman, we show love towards one another in marriages in five, well, in any situation really, but especially marriages, in five main ways. Now, these five ways, they may have different flavors, different dialects, he calls them, but there are five main ways to show love for one another. I want to go through those because we really should be speaking all five of these love languages, but the idea is we should focus on the ones that are our spouse's love languages. So, for example, acts of service. Some people show their love through serving other people. I love you, so let me serve you. Let me do this for you. That's how they show love for one another. And vice versa, that's how they feel the most loved, is when they receive acts of service, when somebody does things for them. That is a love language. Words of affirmation are another love language. Some people really feel loved when they hear words of affirmation. They hear compliments, not flattery, but compliments. You know, when you say to your wife, hey, you know, I value your opinion here. What do you think about this situation? What's some advice you can give me here? Valuing their opinion. Words of affirmation are really important. And also, if your love language is words of affirmation, cutting words can really hurt. Because that's the opposite of love in this case. Small gifts. Some people feel really loved by small gifts. It means, hey, you were away from me throughout the day, and you saw something, you thought of me, and you got it. That's awesome. And it doesn't have to be anything, something necessarily that you bought. It could be something that you put together, you made. And they show love through giving small gifts to other people. Physical touch is another way. That is, it's another love language. Some people just feel loved when you with a hug or a casual touch of the hand or you know, that kind of thing. And they feel love when they do it, or they express love when they do it, and they feel love when they receive it. And also quality time is the fifth one. Some people just feel loved by spending time talking to one another. Quality time. That's not time necessarily in front of the TV, you know, where you're staring away from each other. It's time sitting looking at each other. That's quality time, where you can talk about the events of the day. You can talk about it's your opinion on articles that you've read and so forth. And so, you know, and when my marriage was falling apart, well, however many years ago that was, you know, we didn't know about this. And we read this, and it was like a light went off. Oh, my gosh. You know, Chapman even talked about in his book how a husband whose love language is physical touch will come home from work, and his wife will be elbow deep in the dishes or whatever, or in the middle of something. He'll give her a big hug, and she'll say, "Ah, get off me, I'm busy." And he feels unloved. That means she doesn't love me. That, to her, she means I'm busy. To him, it means she doesn't love me. And I'm like, yep, he's right. Because that was mine. That's true. I felt that way when she did those things to me. And for her, it was no big deal because that's not her love language. Hers was quality time. And we'd come home from work and we'd sit down and have dinner together. And she would ask me, how was work today? And I would say, fine. End of quality time. What I say is, you know, I'm tired and I don't really talk about it. My work is boring. You know, I'm doing things that you probably don't, you know, you're not interested in. And if I told you the details about the program I'm writing, you probably would glaze over and not care anyway. And what she heard was, he doesn't care enough about me to even tell me about his day. And if that goes on long enough, she heard he's hiding something. He's doing something that he doesn't want to talk about. That's where this can go. And so when we read this about quality time and physical touch and how these are our love languages, we discovered, all right, I need to make an effort to speak her love language. I need to make an effort to talk more about my day. I need to make an effort to talk to her about her thoughts, get into her head a little bit, see how she thinks, and let her into mine and see how I think. So we can talk about it. So we'll read news articles, and a lot of times we read the same things, you know, and we'll talk about how what's going on here. What do you think about that? You know, we'll have conversations about that. That's quality time. And we need to be able to speak one another's love languages. So we, you know, because you may feel love towards your spouse, but if you're speaking the wrong love language, they won't feel it. They don't know it. That could lead to hardened hearts. What I'm saying here is if you want to overcome, prayer is another one. Prayer for and with your spouse is another important way to get past your hardened heart. If you pray for your spouse, God, please take care of her. Not God, please help her to see I'm right. But Lord, please help me to be a better husband to her. Show me where I can serve her. Show me where I'm wrong in this. Help her in this situation that she's got going on at work. Help her to do this obstacle that she's taking on right now. Then you're more inclined to ask her how things are going. Hey, what about this? I've been praying for you. That tells her you're thinking about her. Praying with your spouse. And this is one I'm not as good at because, you know, we just, with time, we just don't do it enough. But this allows you to see what is my spouse praying for? What is it that she goes to God with? What's on her heart? And allows her to see what's on your heart. It draws you closer together. I can't overemphasize how important prayer is in a marriage. What I'm saying is we need to love our spouses. In Ephesians 5:25, he says, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Does that mean that I'm supposed to just try to force these feelings of love? What if I don't feel like loving right now? I don't feel very loving towards my spouse right now. Am I supposed to just force it? I can't just conjure up feelings. That's not at all what we're saying, and it's not what Paul was saying. You know, because you know, what we're confusing here is that love is a feeling. When we look at the definition of love, probably the best definition of love in the Bible is here in 1 Corinthians 3. And it says, love is patient and it's kind. Love is not jealous, does not brag. It's not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own. It is not provoked, it does not take into account wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. It does not say love is a feeling. It does not say that when we're commanded to love other people, it does not command us to feel warm and fuzzy emotions towards people. It says we have to be like this. We have to be patient. We have to be kind instead of mean to them when they don't do the things we want them to do. Not jealous. Love is not jealous. Doesn't brag. You see, you can read through the list. These are actions that we can take. These are decisions that we make. That's how we love another person. And I'm not saying you should never feel feelings for your spouse. That's not at all what I'm saying. What I am saying is how you treat your spouse should not depend on your mood. Going back to Keller's book, he says this, in any relationship, there will be frightening spells in which your feelings of love seem to dry up. When that happens, you must remember that the essence of a marriage is that it is a covenant. The essence of marriage is that it's a covenant. It's a commitment, a promise of future love. You understand that's what marriage is? It's a decision, it's a promise that I will love you for the rest of my life. That's the essence of marriage. It's a commitment, a promise of future love. So what do? You do the acts of love, despite your lack of feeling. You may not feel tender or sympathetic and eager to please, but in your actions, you must be tender, understanding, forgiving, and helpful. And if you do that, as time goes on, you will not only get through the dry spells, but they will become less frequent and less deep. And you will become more constant in your feelings. This is what can happen if you decide to love. Right? Loving is a decision. Loving your spouse is a decision that you may have to make regardless of your feelings. It's a commitment that you made when you made that vow to be married. And it's hard to remember. You know, because you make that commitment when you're all lovey and gushy and you can't get enough of each other. It's fulfilling that commitment once you've been through the war zone for a few years and you're battered and hurt and you've hurt one another. That's a much harder decision to make then. And it won't be easy at all without God. It'll be almost impossible without God. All right, we'll quit there. If you're a first-time guest, that's great. Welcome here. We've got a couple of books, one of which you can have, one or the other. They're free over at the Welcome Center if you're interested. Anybody would like to fill out a welcome card, if you have questions or comments, we're going to have a time for questions here. If you'd like to fill out a question card and drop it in, if you don't feel comfortable asking in front of everybody, that's fine. Let's see here. If this is your church, you have an opportunity during question time to support your church financially. If this is not your church, if you're a guest here, we don't want your money. Just pass that on by. That's cool. All right, so we've got the kids in Oasis for another 20 minutes or so. So we have some time for questions and comments. If you would like to make a comment or have a question, feel free to raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone. You can throw me all the hard balls you want, too. I've made enough mistakes that I can answer some questions about marriage.
Thanks, Adam. Thank you for your candidness more than anything.
You're welcome.
Because that opens the door for the rest of us. I taught on this very subject like 10 days ago in our home group of a different passage.
Mm-hmm.
And God, just like you, was unwilling to let me just teach it. He had to let me live it out.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in a huge argument, and it lasted for days. Mm-hmm. And he taught me a couple things coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And one was, you know, you're not the judge and jury over your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if they do something wrong or even if they didn't, mm-hmm. you're really not the person in charge of judging that person. And you got to refrain from thinking you are the judge and jury because you're not.
Right.
Secondly, he said to me personally, you know, how can you withhold forgiveness from your spouse after all that I've forgiven you for?
Yeah.
And he just reminded me, look in the mirror, young man. You're being an arrogant, you know what? You can't. I mean, if you get to that point in your marriage where you're unforgiving all the time, mm-hmm. you better look in the mirror, because God's trying to tell you, you don't fully understand what I've brought to the table just so that you're forgiven, just so that you're going to one day be in heaven with me.
Right.
And that was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah.
I heard Joyce Meyer talking like a week ago saying, you know, a humble person will seek peace, and a prideful person will just let things go the way they go, you know,
mm-hmm.
the way of the flesh. And that's so true, you know. And I can't say I'm there yet because I don't always seek peace in the middle of a battle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we want to win those battles and we'll stick to our guns like you were talking about.
Yeah.
But the other thing is God is married in front of people because marriage is something, is a covenant to be lived out in community.
Right.
And that it can't be done, you know, just one-on-one. And I can't tell you how many times other people within our Christian community have helped us through difficult times in our marriage and continue to. And if you think you're just going to live this life on your own in your marriage without anybody ever giving you wisdom or help or calming you down or getting you on the right track, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I encourage everybody that's a Christian here today, especially, find somebody, a marriage champion, a marriage veteran, and hook up with them and make sure that the next time you get in that kind of battle with your spouse, that you go seek them out and get some wisdom and regroup.
Yeah, that's a great point, man.
Thanks for your teaching.
Yeah, that's, you know, we want these big elaborate public weddings, and we want our divorces to be quiet, right? We don't want people to know, and that's why they had to have a certificate of divorce to bring that out so people would know what's going on. And, you know, you're right. That's why I brought up in my story about how I talk to people about it. You know, they don't even have to be somebody that's necessarily awesome at giving advice. Just talking it out, not that the people I talked to weren't awesome at it, but it was just sometimes just the act of talking it out with another person, it makes it, you hear how ridiculous you are when you say it out loud. When I say it like that, it sounds like I'm a jerk, you know, because you are a jerk, but you didn't, in your head, you didn't see it. It wasn't until you spoke to somebody else about it. Yeah, it's a great point.
Adam, how do you balance what was taught here with, and I know it's the loving thing to do, but what if there is a genuine issue in your spouse's life that you ought to be speaking into? What's that look like? What's the criteria, that sort of thing?
Well, that's difficult. You know, sometimes the right answer is to say, look, this is an issue that you have to work on. And, you know, I'm willing to help you and I love you. And the loving thing to do is to give them the truth. Remember, the love is patient and kind. It also rejoices in the truth. And we have to be able to speak truth to one another. And sometimes the most loving thing you can do for somebody is to walk away, give them some distance, and let them feel that pressure. You know. And I'm not saying every time your spouse acts up, you threaten to leave. What I am saying is that should be a last resort. But sometimes, man, until you see that, you have that pressure of loneliness, of being separated from your spouse, there's nothing else you can do. But ideally, you've talked about it a lot before that, you know, before you get to that point where, that's the last resort. You know, we should be able to talk to our spouse about, hey, you know, this is, you're wrong here, or you've got an issue here that you need to deal with. And it's never easy. And, you know, and we have to do it in a loving way, not a nagging way. You know, you're not going to nag your spouse to be a better person. You know, you can only love your spouse to be a better person. And, you know, one of the awesome things about, you know, my marriage is that, you know, we are very different. We do have different interests. We have different points of view. And Don's real cool about, hey, you know, you normally react this way. Maybe you should think about this instead, you know. And she's real loving about that. And I'm not saying we've always been good at that, because, you know, I do the same thing for her. And, you know, over the years, we've gotten better at it. Early on, it was like, that's stupid. Don't do that. You know, you're doing something dumb. And that's just judgmental. That's just, I'm telling you this because it bothers me, not because it's hurting you. And when you approach it like you're hurting yourself and you're hurting those you love, then that's a whole different approach. And you can tell the difference. I hope that answers your question. Yeah. Yeah, Amy. Getting the other side of the argument now.
I just wanted to ask the question, what do you think about the scripture, you know, don't let the sun go down in your anger? How do you deal with that or interpret that? Or?
Well, that's a good question, because obviously that's not a hard and fast rule, because sometimes the sun doesn't go down. Like, if you live depending on where you live, you know, sometimes it can be 6 months. Yeah, so we can't take that literally every time, obviously. What we can do is say, right, that's a loophole, exactly. What we have to say is, don't let it stuff stew, and don't let it go on, is what what that means. Don't just let your anger last for days and days and then just fade away, and then it becomes, because it hardens your heart. What you need to do is you need to address stuff. You know, and I understand that when you're angry and super angry, that that's not the best time to talk about things sometimes. You know, we've had arguments where I'm like, you know what? I need to call a timeout. I'm going to say some things now that I don't want to say and I'm going to regret. So I'm going to take a break from that and come back to it. You know, does that mean that we have to talk about it before we go to bed? I don't think that's necessarily the case. It's not a bad idea, though. I mean, we should never just let stuff sit and stew, because it will infect us. It'll infect our hearts and it'll harden our hearts towards our spouses. And it's important to talk this stuff out and resolve our issues with each other as soon as you can. And if that means that you can take a few hours or even maybe even a day to so you're not responding in anger and insulting your spouse, but you want to respond coolly and calmly and talk things out, then that may be what it takes. But you should never just let it go and sweep it under the rug and then let it disappear, because it's not gone. You know, someday you're going to move that rug and all these monsters are going to come out of there, and it'll be bad. So you got to address that stuff as soon as you can. Yeah. Any other questions? Pat.
I don't have a question. I have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say, you know, as somebody who's walked through divorce and experienced everything that comes with that, mm-hmm. In my own life, in my kids' life, and is far-reaching. You know, the effects of it are very, very far-reaching.
Yeah.
And, but I love in the scripture, all over the place, where it says, but God,
mm-hmm.
you know, and God is a God of second chances. And he redeems broken people, broken lives. He brings healing to kids who are messed up through their parents' sin or what, you know, whatever. And I guess, you know, I guess I would just say that looking to the Lord and understanding complete forgiveness in him, and the fact that not only does he forgive you, but he has a role for you. You know, I remember coming out of that and thinking, I'm damaged.
Yeah.
God will never be able to use me for any good purpose here. I'm grateful to be saved, and I'm grateful, you know, that he's teaching me to forgive, but...
Yeah.
I've just learned over the years that God is incredibly more gracious and loving and faithful and understanding and caring for me than I could have ever imagined.
Yeah.
You know, and so I guess that's all I want to say about that, that God is, he understands you, he understands your situation better than you know it yourself.
Yeah.
And if you... just keep on looking to him. He'll do amazing things in your life to redeem you.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, I love hearing stories like that, especially when we're talking about divorce, but from hearing from people who've been through it and have learned from it, you know, and have learned to trust God more and learned about God's healing hands on their hearts and then able to go into another marriage not cynically, not assuming that it's going to end too, but with a real commitment and with, instead of having baggage, having experience behind you to make this new one work. You know, God's real good at turning baggage into something that's important, to something, to experience that we can use. Thanks for sharing that. Anybody else want to talk about divorce or marriage or anything else? All right. We'll take a moment to pray together, and then we'll have some time to hang out.